sense or a change of atmosphere that allows you to perhaps feel a sense of privacy in public. I think that sense of privacy in public is very important. I also think it's very analogous to a musical performance, or any kind of performance in a way. A performance is something that's very private, but often done publicly. That's what makes it a performance. This evening we're going to go to two or three different sites, which some aren't particularly close to here. But the whole thing will last about 90 minutes, which is much shorter than a blockbuster movie, so I hope you don't get bored. I'd like to thank all of our funders for making this possible. They are all listed in the back of our booklet. There'll be some places where we go where I'd like you to be particularly careful whilst walking along the side of busy roads, because my insurance probably covers one of you getting hit, but not two or three. Is there anything else, Brian? That's fine. Anything else should come to our
mind.
If you'd like to come with me, we're going to walk to our first site.
Okay. If you don't stand there, any needles.
Funny offices or something. They're like funny offices. Ha ha ha.
see it. Did you care for the seed?
Although the gate was unlocked for you, the gate is not ordinarily unlocked. So even to be here in the space where you can really be seen by the people on the bridge, when a bus comes by, everybody can look down in here. You've got to engage in an activity, a behavior that doesn't really wash in public just to get in here. And if you walk under the bridge, you're in a much more shadowed space. And if you do what we had to do to get down to that performance space tonight, go through that pile of bushes, you're in a really shadowed space. At least from this end. There's nothing, of course, to say that this is the way you have to come into this space. And in fact, apparently the locals, by and large, use it as a shortcut. They just jump the fence, and there's a food market over there. They can go to other places just by using this as a shortcut to get to other places. Seems to be a lot of what it's used for, although very clearly a lot of other things go on here as well. For the last 2 weeks, we visited a lot of shadowed spaces in Scotland. We started with a deserted, abandoned railroad turntable in Aberdeen, and we visited a abandoned building site and a close, very close in Dundee. In Newcastle, what did we do in Newcastle? It was fantastic. Oh, we played a deserted and abandoned community center and library in Easterhouse. Oh, I'm sorry, that's Easterhouse. Then in Newcastle, we played a bridge that just ran off and stopped in the middle of nowhere, and a underpass somewhat similar to this, but with a very, very different kind of feel to it. And then in Cumbernauld, we played in the strange stairwells and corridors of what many people apparently think is the ugliest building in Britain, but which is a very interesting building in any case. And here we are tonight playing here, and in the site we'll be taking you to once I've finished talking to you for a sec. The shadow spaces are of intense interest to psychogeographers of either of the two historical stripes that I'm really interested in. One of these goes back to the early 1950s when Guy Debord coined the word in any of its contemporary uses. He's one of the coiners of the word in any of its contemporary uses. He was, at the time, a member of the Lettrists, an avant-garde sort of splinter in Paris. One of the fallouts of the sort of devolving surrealist involvement. And in fact, he wasn't to stay a Lettrist very long. He morphed from just a Lettrist into the Lettrist International, and then he became a situationist in rapid order. Not in rapid order. There were a number of steps in there. Along the way, however, he enunciated his interest in something he called psychogeography, which was posited to be the study of the relationship of the environment to human beings and human beings to the environment. And it was a relationship that he proposed to study in a variety of ways, but the technique that he was most interested in and that he devoted most attention to was what he called a derive, or drift, which was a way, he felt, of allowing the urban environment, the city, to speak to him or to speak to people. Drifts have become really kind of popular lately, but I think that one of the things that has been lost as they become popular is the kind of rigor they really demand. One of the things that's characteristic of all the places that we visited in these past 2 weeks is that they've been vacated of the intentions that brought them into being. This is no longer an active rail site. And with that intention withdrawn and none rushing in to fill that void, the space is, as it were, unintentioned, intentionless, agendaless. It's an open space, a free space, and a space that, in fact, can be used as we've used it tonight, and that has the power to evoke the kinds of sounds that you heard from our musicians tonight. This lack of agenda, this lack of intention, is what you have to achieve if you're going to drift in any kind of reasonable way. The board felt that the city was compounded of islands of attraction that he called unities of ambience. These were places with a peculiarly powerful urban character that drew you in, that attracted you, and of spaces that completely lack this character, and those would repulse you. And he felt that you could be pulled by the city and pushed by the city if you let yourself. And to let yourself be pushed and pulled by the city, you had to free yourself of your need to get someplace, of your need to go there and have an agenda and a goal that will determine precisely, you know, where you're going to go. I'm going to go there, therefore I have to do a walk here, I have to walk there. The city can't pull you and push you under those circumstances. So what you have to do is you have to empty yourself of intention, just as these spaces have been emptied of intention. And that's not easy to do. I don't know how many of you have tried it, but it's harder than you think. And even if you begin and you get going, it's surprising how readily, ooh, I forgot, I have to, bang, and that comes in, and suddenly you're off the drift and moving someplace entirely different. The board mapped these places in groups of 3, 4, 5, 6. He wanted to drift together with other people to ensure the objectivity, as he called it, the objectivity of these pushes and pulls. He felt that if you were just by yourself, okay, maybe idiosyncratic subjectivities could also enter into it and interfere with the resonance of these spaces. But if you were drifting together, those would somehow cancel each other out. So 3 or 4 or 5 people drifting together would ensure you of being able to find those unities of ambience with that particularly powerful erratic quality that he felt was so important. The other aspect of that drifting together was that he was able to objectify what he felt was a kind of desire matrix that operated in the city, and that if you drifted together in these ways and found these places, you could reveal the city as a terrain of passion. He mapped these. He cut little sections of maps out that were these unities of ambience, and he pasted them down, connecting them with red arrows that indicated the pushes and the pulls. He made 2 of these maps. In 56, he made Discourse on Love, and in 57, with Asger Jorn, he made The Naked City. And these maps have gone on to have a really powerful career. They've magnetized people's attention in ways that I don't think he could possibly have imagined. I think it's important to note that the Situationists were never numerous. There were just handfuls of them. And that by the time the early 70s came around, they were gone. Situationism is not a word that the board would allow to be spoken in his presence. The Situationists stopped being Situationists in the early 70s. And they were forgotten for about 20 years. With the growing popularity and importance of his book, The Society of the Spectacle, his work became increasingly translated, and with these translations, people began to read these early papers that he wrote, and one of the things they discovered among them was the idea of the drift, was the idea of psychogeography. And starting in the early 90s, these ideas gained a lot of currency and became important strand in contemporary thinking about the environment, but a real one nonetheless. So there's that strand of psychogeography. At the same time that DeBoard was carrying out his work, an urban planner named Kevin Lynch was doing very, very dissimilar, but very, very related work in Boston, Massachusetts. The thing that connects Lynch and DeBoard in the beginning is the fact that they're motivated by a powerful fear, distaste, and dislike of the urban planning that was being carried out in their environments in the 50s. DeBoard particularly concerned with Paris, and Lynch in the beginning particularly concerned with Boston, but also with other American cities. Lynch was driven to ask himself how it was that people understood their cities? How did they perceive their cities? How did they know about their cities? How did they feel toward their cities? This is a very Debordian kind of question in a way. But he's an MIT planner. He's at an engineering school, and instead of drifting, he administered questionnaires. He walked people through the city and tape recorded their remarks about the environment. He asked them to identify photos. He asked them to make sketch maps of their environment. He asked them to create lists of places they liked and disliked. He asked them to give directions from one place to the other. And out of all these materials, he was able to pull a series of maps that spoke to the image of, in the beginning, Boston, and then he replicated this work in Jersey City and later in Los Angeles. And in 1960, he publishes The Image of the City. The Image of the City is one of these crazy books. It's a planning book, but it's been in print continuously since 1960, and has been read by millions of people. Again, though, despite that, the kind of work that he was engaged in caught fire only in a very few strange places. One of them was in a psychologist named David Stay. David Stay came to Clark University, which had a very, very well-known and important geography program, and this geography program hired David Stay. And he began teaching a course in the environment and psychology. And pretty soon, the students called it psychogeography, and the second year that he taught it, it was officially called psychogeography. And psychogeography became a discipline in geography for, it had a run of 6, 7, 8 years. And carried out a lot of work in human perception of the environment. People doing investigations of how ordinary citizens saw their cities in Venezuela and Mexico and the Caribbean islands, throughout American cities, numerous European cities, Jerusalem. Again, this tradition sort of died away. It certainly died away in geography. A lot of the people who were involved in it went off to found or to work in environmental psychology programs. And in fact, most of what was psychogeography in the 60s, and late 60s and 70s, has become environmental psychology today, where I feel it's lost most of its environment. It's held on to its psychology, but it's lost its environment. Again, it died. And it was revived once again only on the tales of Debord's psychogeography. Debord's psychogeography begins to be popular in the 90s, and people say, whoa, psychogeography, that's not some crazy thing done in Paris. That's this stuff done by these geographers and psychologists. And the Debordian people were like, what are you talking about? Psychogeography is... So there was this sort of mutual door opening, and these two traditions have really fruitfully supported each other in their movement toward whatever's going on today, whatever that might be. Why is psychogeography interested in the shadowed spaces? Because the shadowed spaces are a peculiarly important fulcrum in the human environment interface. They are spaces that say to us many of the things that Debord wanted to hear his environment saying. They speak with a peculiarly concentrated authority, peculiarly concentrated power, which, I don't know, I sort of felt you all felt as you emerged from the tunnel of bushes. I was sort of watching you come through there, and it was like you'd come through into another world. And in fact, it was another world down there with a sort of an amazing space down there. So A, that aspect of it. B, it's not marked by any of the normative, highly agended practices that drove both Lynch and Debord nuts about the environment. These are spaces that don't have the heavy-handed, this is what we're going to do here, this is what needs to be done there, feeling of the planned environment. Park here, don't park for more than 3 hours, move there, this is where you have to go to the toilet, and so forth. These spaces don't have that. These spaces are sublimely free of those kinds of things. At the same time, they point to a whole range of human behaviors that need to be carried on in spaces like these that can't be carried on in spaces where the normative eye, you know, can see what you're up to. I don't know that Can anybody see a closer camera here?
We might actually be, wow, out of sight. Okay, that's pretty hard to do these days. The normative eye is not just something that your mother or your wife or your husband or your local neighbors or others have. In fact, it's been institutionalized and built into the physical environment in very, very serious kinds of ways. In fact, that kind of an idea, that you would make spaces safe by making them completely surveillant, that kind of Foucauldian panopticon vision of existence, is, of course, precisely the thing that the shadowed spaces are most about evading and escaping and denying. And because of that, they have a very rich and important place in our life that goes well beyond the kind of graffiti and the needles that we found scattered in every one of these sites in abundance, etc. It goes way, way beyond that. Shadowed spaces are places where you can do things that aren't going to be approved by authorities. And that doesn't just mean, you know, sort of petty, recently criminalized activities. That means the full range of innovative to revolutionary activities that, if they're carried out in daylight, get squashed. And we're talking about things as relatively innocuous as art movements that become Dada or become Situationism. Ooh, I said it. No, that become the work that the Situationists carried out. And it also becomes, of course, political revolutions. These are also things that cannot stand the light of day and need to be carried out in the dark. So the shadowed spaces, in fact, become revealed as a kind of space that really does need to be defended against the surveillant. There you go. See how easily you can be seen from the bus? Well, that took care of that thought. And that note, I think we should go on to our next really shadowed space. And I guess we'll just follow Bryony out to it.